we are stuck in this kind of momentum, and that requires now, in the limits of our system, requires now a massive international agreement, but we are failing to do so. We are failing to do so. There is a report recently that was saying like, oh, the 1.5 degrees is still achievable from a physical point of view. They were saying this, but from a political point of view, it doesn't sound like a reality.
Hello and welcome to Planet Critical, the podcast for a world in crisis. My name is Rachel Donald. I'm a climate corruption journalist and your host. Every week I interview experts who are battling to save our planet. My guests are scientists, politicians, academics, journalists, and activists. They explain the complexities of the energy, economic, political, and cultural crises we face today, revealing what's really going on and what they think needs to be done. These are the stories of the big picture. Go to planetcritical.com to learn more and subscribe. My guest this week is Jonathan Meal. Jonathan is a research fellow in climate change at the University College London Climate Action Unit, studying systemic risk and the impact of interdependence and interconnection on our global systems and how we respond to the climate crisis. I tell this story in the interview, but Jonathan and I actually met on the Eurostar and had such a fascinating conversation that I invited him on the show. Our train conversation focused on the energy transition and resources, and I thought that was maybe what we would talk about, but we ended up talking about the psychological transition, the narratives that perpetuate a certain system that impede us from taking action, and the transformation of story that has to happen alongside an energy and economic transformation. This is a brilliant conversation that touches on resources, economic theory, system dynamics, risk management, supply chains, the ruling class, narrative, and the resilience of humanity. Our ability to network. I just need to add here that a few weeks after recording, Jonathan and I were talking, and he wanted to impress the fact that he really does not think that we will make the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit, that even if we stopped emitting today, we would blast right past the target set by the Paris agreements. Unfortunately, he now thinks that an additional 3 to 5 degrees Celsius warming is much more plausible, given the failure to act from governments around the world. I hope you all enjoy the episode. If you do, please share it far and wide. And if you're loving the show, support Planet Critical with a paid subscription at planetcritical.com. By signing up, you'll get the Planet Critical newsletter inspired by each episode delivered straight to your inbox every week. You'll also have access to the wonderful Planet Critical community, who are full of inspiring thoughts, ideas, critiques, and determination. I'm so grateful to everyone who chooses to support the project. I'm a vehement believer in ad-free and open-access content, so Planet Critical wouldn't exist without the direct support of the amazing community. Thank you so much to all of you who believe in Planet Critical and keep the project going every week. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining me on Planet Critical. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure to have me. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I think we should tell the story very quickly of how we met, because it's so random and bizarre before we jump in. So we were sitting next to each other on a Eurostar. I was bashing out a very angry article about Rishi Sunak rolling back, you know, climate policies. And you were kind of responding very tensely and silently to some Zoom call that you were in. And I couldn't help but look over and saw the words climate. And we just struck up a conversation. And it was just the most fascinating Eurostar journey I think I've ever had.
We're really glad this happened. No, actually, I agree with you. It was really like, crazy, this kind of coincidences. Like, okay, yeah, that's fine. We actually working together, like sat next to each other on the same kind of topic. Actually, like saying, like, hang on a minute, we should talk. Actually, that would be fun.
I know, the poor people around us, because it got quite lively as well in French and English and Franglais.
that was really intense. Actually, after that, I discussed with my friend, saying like, what happened? They were like, of course, it had to happen to you. Of course. Anyway.
So let's try and have that conversation again, really, for everybody else. So I'm going to kick off with the first question. Why is the world in crisis?
I have so many reasons. When you had this, like, over the email, for the last weeks, I've been reflecting on why it's in crisis, and I couldn't help myself to say, like, it's not only a crisis. It's actually like So my background is actually on risk management as well in natural hazards. And I'm trying to bridge like physical senses and social senses together. Like, for me, this bridge is a science on its own. And we can say there is a global crisis, yes, of course, but actually this global crisis is a multitude of crises. So in my field, we're calling this the polycrisis momentum, where actually we're having like this kind of several crises coming all together at the same point. But there's also like in the world crisis, and still I'm just looking from this kind of core definition of crisis as well, which is interesting. You know, crisis is something brutal. It's completely abrupt, actually. It's like an event, like a moment. And actually, it's not supposed to last. You have this kind of peak of the crisis, and then you're going toward a resolution. But the thing is, where we are heading toward right now is actually like definitely not, it doesn't look, it's also on my own opinion, everything I'm saying here, but it doesn't sound like this is just one small moment. It's actually like a big moment. It sounds to be like a long moment that's going to stay for quite a long time, where we're going to face different kinds of crises. It could be a natural hazard somewhere, an extreme somewhere, but it could be like a political crisis. Are we seeing a migration problem as well? That's when I'm seeing migration problems, actually more from a political side of you, that they do not know how to answer these kind of things. That's going to happen like globally and different location and sometimes at the same time. And this is actually the multitude of this combining all together that create this kind of trend of risk that's increasing and increasing the vulnerability in our societies. I could go on forever on this, but the point is actually like when you're saying why the world's in crisis, it's actually like the global crisis, yes, the global existential risks are quite real. And on top of this now, we're just living in a continuous crisis mode actually. We're not used to this anymore, which is actually like a massive problem as well, because we're not prepared. We are not definitely not prepared. And this also is another crisis on its own. This is the core of my work is there, is actually to say like, well, actually, like, yeah, we're facing risk. We're facing different kind of hazards. And because the world is changing right now, we do not understand the fact that we are not able to solve this crisis as we used to solve them before, because it's completely new. It's absolutely like never experienced before.
How did we used to solve? How did we used to solve crises?
I mean, we think we can solve crises in some way. But I would say that over the last decades, century, we developed like mitigation strategies, resilience strategies that we're trying to implement the best as we can, actually, to avoid the maximum impact of any kind of extreme events, no matter the type of extreme events. It could be like natural, but also anthropogenic, okay? So we're having this kind of strategy we developed like this. But the thing is, like, it's just cope with the problem. And in our field, we often say, it's often said as well, I would say, that we're focusing on recovering rather than prevention. Because it's easier like to show that, oh, we had a problem, we had an impact, we spent money there, actually, and you can see we recovered from this. So basically, like from a politician perspective or even as an economical perspective, showing that, yeah, you can assess like that was destroyed, it's not anymore. So this is actually like, there is something good that happened, right? So it's easier to invest money that way rather than invest money in prevention, because when you put money on prevention, you don't really see actually like the effect of it clearly, because I mean, it's really, really tiny and really shallow, but it's not like as massive as rebuilding something that's been completely destroyed. All right. So it's less visible, the perception of this. And one of the point, by the way, I'm just jumping straight on this. One of the point that you like of the, your question you asked me in the training here, I think one of the problems is actually the narratives that we developed for the last 200 years. And I'm sure it's going to loop back with many people you have interviewed here. Like I'm thinking about Timothy Parik or Ekel. But the thing is, it's the narrative we're putting ourselves into that we all of us believe like naturally like, oh, growth is the perfect stuff to do. But like green growth is going to be the solution of this. It's actually this kind of narrative that we have plunged into it from a really young age, and we do not challenge them. And why it's in crisis, one of the big answers I had was actually this, is we have this false perception and this kind of narrative that may have worked before for the development we're having, because all the time we need also to understand it's gray, it's not black or white. It's like a lot of nuance of grays. And of course, the developments of our society and growth helped us to have hospitals, to have like many infrastructures that we're having today. And this is something that we have to say as well. Yes, indeed, it created this. But it's like, as I'm saying to my students, it's also a domino effect. When you're doing something on one side, you have automatically consequences on the other side. There is no, it's not only on one trend, okay? it's impossible. So if you're doing something like, if you want to develop the railways in a country, this is really great. You're going to increase automatically the transportation by rail in your country, right? I mean, depending on those factors, but yes. But on the other side, mechanically, you're going to decrease your resources of copper, of iron, anything else. So each time we're going to move something in the system, it has repercussions. It has impact. And this is why I wanted to link this with part of the work I'm doing as well, is actually like risk, systemic risks. And integrating this within our governance strategies, decision makers, risk managers, and even within us, stop thinking that we are alone, but you are part of a system. And we need to understand that this is because we are part of the decision. When we're moving something, we can have cascading effect, temporally speaking, spatially speaking. And if we do not integrate this kind of systemic component we are in now with the globalization we've been facing for the last 60, 70 years, approximately, if we fail to understand that the system is changing fast and we are highly interconnected and highly interdependent, all of the key elements in our supply chain, if one of them change, could have massive repercussion that we do not assess because we don't have the tools to do that correctly.
There's something about the story of all of this and how, like, the story of national politics on an international stage, so geopolitics, is essentially attempting to hide, like, the interconnectedness, because we're still sort of falling into this old story of there being, like, heroes and there being dominant powers and superpowers and hegemonies, which I think is why we're so often seeing citizens around the world being very confused as to why governments will kind of like pay lip service to outrage, say, but then not take any actions as to actually sanction or punish or attempt to use their power, unless it's against Russia, obviously, because they're so dependent on one another. And it's like, how do I put this? It's like this desire still for dominance rather than like a recognition of an inherent like equality or interconnectedness.
Right.
And it seems like until we go beyond that politically, we will still be sort of caught in this crisis of response, which is only being able to respond on a national level, only responding with the narrative of growth. Also completely like, you know, gaslighting the entire world about the access to resources that we have and the finitude of those resources.
I see your point. I see your point here. I would like to highlight something here because you said like hiding stuff. So far from my personal experiences, when I've been interviewing people in my work and research and stuff like that, I have to say that I don't know if they're honest or not, but I'm going to tell you what I've seen and what I've discussed with. Whatever I started to discuss about, because my research is, the title of my research is Interconnections and Interdependencies in Risk Management in a Climate Change and Energy Transition Context. When I was interviewing them, I realized that a lot of them actually were not aware, were not trained, I would say. So I understand your point on the hiding stuff. I'm sure some people does. It's not a do that. I'm sorry. But the point is, for some, actually, I realize that it's also a question of, again, narratives that has been educated with. And this is why I'm telling you, like, why the world is in crisis. And I think it's really linked with the narrative we're implementing and not challenging it for what it is, for what it is from a physical perspective of it. Like, why it doesn't work like this? And some of the people I've been discussing with, like, they'd never questioned just the idea of resources and the limits of our world. Never, because it never come across. And it's something that, to me, personal opinion on this, like, we all take this for granted. We're taking the world as it works for us for granted. And again, it's a narrative, a cognitive bias that we're having in our minds. That's thinking that that's completely fine. I'm still going to have food, whatever I want to go to Leclerc, Tesco, wherever, which country you are. It's like, energy will be still here forever. We'll still be able to grow, to develop more and more and more and more and infinitely. So without questioning the question of the dependencies and therefore the needs in psychology that we're having to sustain and maintain the way of life we're having today, this is where we're going to keep going to be into crisis and crisis and crisis and crisis again and again and again. Because we do not And like, even though I understand your point again, like some people hide, but some people are just not even aware. And when you're not aware of your needs, you're not aware of your vulnerabilities. I do not say that the leaders do not know that, but the common ground, the common people, most of them have been discussing. So from, again, my perspective of what I've been discussing with and interviewing people, do not just even question this.
I agree, right? And I think that...
Oh, there is a butt coming.
Yes, I think that these are things that most people just don't think about. And as you were talking, I thought, oh, it's interesting as well that we don't realize how interconnected we are and that things don't have repercussions because we're such social creatures and we're so frightened of not fitting in and we're so aware of what our impact on other people and being in or out of the group. So there's definitely, we're definitely wired to see interconnection in some way. Yes, in terms of resources and energy and what it is and where it comes from, the planet and all this kind of stuff, like when you live in a society of abundance, it's very, very difficult to understand the finitude of that thing. But
absolutely.
But the but is, there's the but. Of course. In terms of leaders, in terms of political leaders, in terms of strategies, whether it's documents now being declassified, you know, decades after events, or whether it's reading the fine print in negotiations, there's a definite awareness at higher levels of government and the military of the finitude of these resources and the desire to access these resources and the desire to control these resources.
Of course. I mean, because part of the research I was doing as well, but just to simplify, is you are a system, you want to grow, right? So if you want to grow, you need to have the access to these key resources. But the territory you are, the country you are in, maybe do not have this kind of resources, right? It's exactly what you said. I completely agree with this. So if you keep going to grow, so again, economically speaking, and what we how we define growth, again, you still need this kind of physical element, resources, energy, wood, whatever you want to grow. And if you can't have access to this, basically you got not a lot of choices. Either you try to make them within your own area, so water you can find some ways in some, but it's going to be limited at some point anyway. Food also is good depending again on your weather conditions, your climate and stuff. But when we started to talk about minerals, when you start to talk about energy, basically if you don't have this there, you need to find a way to take it. So either you're going to trade or you go on wars to control it or you collapse. Sorry to be like that simple. Of course, there is again a lot of gray that we implement here, but basically, if you need to want to grow like we grow like this, and you can't have access to resources, you don't have these resources within your territory, you either trade, you go to war to control something, or you collapse. If you're in a growing state, trade, or you share, or you find a trade. It could be like sharing in another way. But the thing is, we saw like in history at the moment that we are not really good to share like our resources, like equitably in our systems, right? So, I mean, I don't remember anything that we've done correctly on this in human history so far. So yeah, we are stuck in this kind of momentum and that requires now in the limits of our system, requires now a massive international agreement, but we are failing to do so. There is a report recently that was saying like, oh, the 1.5 degrees is still achievable from a physical point of view. They were saying this, but from a political point of view, it doesn't sound like a reality.
No.
And that was actually like the stuff I was watching in the train when I was next to Kuwait. So, they were also saying this as well. That was not the moment I was starting to be like, well, but this is the point. So politically speaking, like the massive problem that of the why we're in the crisis is because like, we need to definitely level up the game, politically speaking, but we're not taking the direction so far because the economical interests are here.
But people don't understand this link between like growth. Like we talk about economic growth and it's amazing what happens to language once a word gets kind of beaten down into its most one-dimensional. Yeah, exactly. Like, in order to grow, exactly as you said, you need energy. That's, you know, teenagers, that's why they eat a lot. That's why they sleep a lot. Babies constantly sleeping and eating. Like, you need to put something into the system in order for that system to grow. And I really liked what you said, right. Resources like wood. In the past, it was, you know, raising forests for, you know, the engines of a pre-industrial time. And this is what fundamentally seems to be lacking from the conversation politically, or the admittance. I don't know if it is an admittance, a lack of admittance or whatever, but just this idea that, like, if we're going to have our economy grow, there is going to be a one-for-one output with energy use. And where we get that energy matters, because right now we're completely dependent on a fossil-fueled economy. And also, are we ever going to be able to grow in that same way on renewables?
I know
your answer.
No. I mean, so there is no clear answer on this in some ways. I would like to really put a lot of grays in everything, because it's important. It depends on how we see that. Like, matching the level of energy consumption we're having right now with renewables is an extreme challenge. Like, honestly, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. It will have consequences. We want to raise, like, the numbers of electrical cars. Yes, it's also, like, good for many reasons, like in terms of air pollution decreasing, blah, 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 in the country they're going to be used. Mm-hmm. But again, you have a cascading effect somewhere else. You're going to destroy some environment in Chile, in China, in Australia. Mm-hmm. So it has consequences. It doesn't mean that I'm not saying what we should do or not. It's not what I'm saying here. I'm saying, like, replacing everything as a system that when you're talking something somewhere, you're going to have consequences somewhere else. I mean, and I did not invent anything. I'm saying this, like, Lavoisier said that, like, nothing is created, nothing is lost, everything is transformed, right? So it's been a long time it has been said, but it's exactly the same for our economy. It's exactly the same for any new things we're implementing into our systems. To answer to one problem is going to create other problem locally speaking somewhere else. It's going to create, like, everything is dynamic, basically. It's going to have impact, spatially and temporally speaking. It's just how it is. This is just simple physics here.
It's this entropy.
It's
this entropy.
Yeah. I just wanted to bounce back on this and what you just said as well. This is what I've told you about the narrative, that actually we do not educate really well on this point. It's not like, oh, we got a fascinating solution. It's going to solve everything like that. But it's going also to have consequences, and we need to understand the gray. So, and then we can take decisions, and then it can help to decision makers to go. But understanding that implementing new stuff is going to have consequences somewhere else. That's pure physics.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, can I say just one last sentence like this? It's actually like my students also, we're discussing about this. I'm always saying the same thing in the conferences as well. I'm saying the same is the energy transition is before a psychological transition. We need to understand that. Like, you want to have an energy transition, you need to understand that you have to create also within you and within the community you're living in your family, your relatives, in the city you're living in the country, no matter the scale of the system you are, that we need to understand that this is before all a psychological transition, and therefore created a narrative with this. And this is a problem as well, jumping back on the narrative's point of view. When you do think about this, the narrative of green growth and everything, like, now we're having this kind of technological solution that, oh, technology is going to save us again. Like, Philip Bewick said that a lot of time as well in many documents and books. But the problem is actually, like, we're creating this kind of black again and white, this, like, speech on this thing, like, it's only green growth and technology is going to save us. But yes, but when you're doing this, when we're starting to discuss about the idea of sobriety or degrowth, and Timothy Parry could say that as well, even more, like, you also becoming ostracized automatically, because it's not the common narrative that some leaders pushing us toward, actually, and refuse sometimes to have this kind of gray instead of things. And this actually is also why, for me, is threatening the global crisis we're in, because there is this solution and we're going to take this direction and that's it. No, it's way much more complex than that.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Because there's a saying, those who control the narrative control the world. And so to come out and to say, you know, yeah, this is a problem, and, like, we don't really have a solution, but we are working on it. And the solution might actually have to be really diverse, and it might not be something that we can capitalize on exactly. And it might actually completely screw with our understanding of the market because maybe the free market wasn't the right thing. Maybe we made a mistake. It's political suicide. What? You can't do. And also, I understand why you can't do that in a world in which people are scared. They're frightened. If you look at like the material quality of life for most people now, even in developed countries, cost of living crisis, the energy crisis, the everything crisis, health crisis, mental health crisis. I mean, people, of course, right? When you can zoom out, when you have the time and the space to zoom out and see how they're all interlinked, tackling one becomes part of the solution of tackling all of them. And yet you can understand why people just cannot cope with the idea that the people in charge don't know what they're doing. Because we do live in, even though we kind of have this like free market reign over the global north, we do still kind of live in nanny states, given like how much they divert money in order to like stimulate markets and then stimulate their citizenship. And so when you live in a world that you're told a certain way and don't think too critically, otherwise you'll probably start to freak out and have existential crises and become an artist, and then you won't be very valuable to the economy. You can understand why people, A, can't cope with it, and also why political leaders don't know what to say about it.
As I said in the trend, remember, one of the expressions, the popcorning, like, it's like creating a popcorn in my mouth. So when you say the first thoughts I have is actually like, this is why we're developing way much more in the research center I'm working with at the moment, is like this kind of systemic point of view on things is my work and how I'm approaching these challenges. I'm seeing this from eagle eye vision, like from above, basically. I'm trying as much as I can. Of course, I'm biased because I'm part of the system, but what I'm trying to do is actually like trying to look from above and see how things are interconnected with each other, how they work with each other, and how they are intertwined, basically. And exactly this is why I love when you said that we're having this kind of crisis. It's actually like, it's linked. I mean, there is no, for me, from what I've been sitting for the last 8-10 years, it's actually like, this is not, for me and for many others, by the way, it's not surprising. It's again, what I told you, you push some dominoes there, and at some point, it's like you increasing stresses over the system over years. It's like an earthquake.
Yeah.
And at some point, you can't keep continuing to apply the same stress to the system without it to break at some point. It has to. It has to find like it's like tiny little cracks before the massive earthquake coming in, like, and then rupture. Okay, so I don't know how the rupture will be, if it will be a rupture and how it's going to go, because maybe it could be like small ruptures in different places in the system because it's globalized right now. But there is a lot of literature that says that actually more you interconnected and intradependent, more the stress is applied to a system is going to make it abruptly like collapse, rather than if you have tiny sockets everywhere in your system that it's quite not, is dependent, but not ultra dependent. When you're applying the same stress, actually, like the system is able to progressively adapt to a new normal and new state without having this massive abrupt rupture. And this is actually like where the globalization also provided a lot of opportunities, but also weakened. I mean, I'm not saying this is a good thing. Don't take it wrong. I'm saying it created opportunities for some people. It did. But it actually created a version of the system that make us highly dependent and vulnerable. And now the level of vulnerability, especially in developed countries, because we are most of the time, we're now like a service country, basically, all the key infrastructures, basically, and the key resources, we do not own them anymore. So if you just remove them and you are just a service society, but your suppliers somewhere far away, stop saying, no, I'm going to actually keep my all for myself right now because we're having a decrease of this. But just deal with your own stuff, guys. Mm-hmm. Hello, guys. All the services that actually is above, actually, is just collapsing.
I know. And right. This is what's so funny about even the concept of GDP and the richest nations and all of this kind of stuff. Because like India a few months ago in 2023... banned all exports of rice because, you know, climate change is screwing with the weather. And so the harvest was low. And they were like, right, we need to feed our own people first. Then it's like, and that's, you know, that barely made headlines in the sense of like the panic that that should ensue across, you know, the global.
I'm so glad you said that.
Like people are just like, oh, yeah, okay. That's it's like, I'm sorry, where do you think all of our food come? I mean, certainly in the United Kingdom, 60% of our food is imported. We are incredibly, incredibly vulnerable. To think that countries will not take a nationalist approach and that these countries that are richest because they supply services to the richest around the world will not then become the most vulnerable because they're not actually doing, because they're outsourcing all of the hard work in terms of like industrialization and engineering and food. It's just madness. I mean,
it's
going to reveal, I think, the illusion of like economics in it overnight, essentially.
I'm so happy you said that because, yeah, I definitely agree on this. On the thing is, yeah, they do not realize the level. Again, this is actually looping back to what I said like 10 minutes ago. We do not understand our level of dependencies. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's not communicated as well. Or some people may know, but it's not communicated widely, broadly. And actually, that this also increases this kind of crisis momentum. Because actually, if you knew where are your dependencies and you educated people, people are going to naturally try to look, at least if they are really concerned by this, they're going to look for mitigation strategies. They're going to look for resilience strategies and try to implement a bit more robustness within the system to be sure that if they are so dependent on rice, for example, as you said, like you're a massive culture depending on rice, actually your main supplier stop providing you this, what do we do then? Instead of just seeing the prices increasing in our shops, fine, this is how we live. And at the moment, some people say, oh, that's fine. There is less rice coming on the market. It's still going to increase a little bit the price because we can find other suppliers. Fine at that stage, potentially. But what about in 10, 20, 30 years from now, when climate change is going to increase the problem, change actually the climatic conditions on some producers, and then we cannot produce as we do. We've been thinking like constantly like, oh, climate is changing, that's fine. We can use more and more energy to compensate the climate that is changing, right? But the thing is, if you got less energy coming into the system as well, or it's more difficult for you to get this kind of maintaining the same level of energy in your system or increasing it if you want to grow, then you cannot compensate the impact of climate change on your food production, for example. So what do you do? Like one of the massive stuff, and we're talking about food and the variety we're having right now, Spain is providing a lot of vegetables and fruit for all over Europe, right? But Spain is facing a massive climate change at the moment, potential desertification, less water resources and stuff like this, right? So what does it mean? You said in the UK, like most of the fruits we can find in Tesco or Sainsbury actually are coming from Spain, not from the UK because they don't produce lemon, oranges, actually like all the time, all over the year, by the way. So this kind of not questioning, again, this is what I told you at the beginning, not questioning this level of dependencies is our main vulnerability because we are not aware of it. And this is where my work lies, actually. Like, wake up, you're a decision maker. There is still time to readapt our system to make it more robust, to decrease the impact of this change coming on right now. Because if you don't now, the impact down the line, as I told you, in recovery will be, where are you? And you might not be able to recover as well. Now,
what does a more robust system look like then? As saying we don't go down the path of like eco-fascism where it's every, you know, man for himself or every nation for himself. What does a robust, fairly global system look like?
Global system.
Achievable.
I need to send you this paper. That they were saying, like, you know, I told you about the ultra connectivity system and the one actually is not that connected. So this one is the best at the moment. It's like basically from a systemic point of view and again from a physical point of view, how I'm formulating the answer to this problem is actually like we need to reduce our spatial scales for any kind of activities we're doing.
Localize.
Yeah, to some extent. And this is this is what you said, nationalism. I think, yeah, this kind of nationalism and I would say protectiveness, I would say we're starting to see more and more in our systems is going to raise as well because mechanically, if you cannot sustain yourself in a globalized world, if you've got less energy and like for whatever reason, it's going to be more expensive, it's going to be more complicated. Basically, if you can just assemble back some of your key needs and key resources and key industries within your system, then you are less vulnerable to external changes of your system. So, but the thing is, your own system now with climate change is also going to change. So you can get less water, for example. So if you want to reindustrialize some areas, for example, in France, that's fine, but it's going to require way much more resources also coming in into the system. And if you have like a climate change, for example, that's changed your water resources, therefore you might not be able to produce the same way. So we need to readapt the system, not only according to relocalize and actually like decrease the spatial scales, but also to the changing environment that's coming at the same time, and the change also in energy supplies. So yeah, so it's a massive challenge. And if you want to have a more robust system, you need to integrate these new components now that you're going to play with. It's like, basically, for years, we used to play with Monopoly. Mm-hmm. And now I'm telling you, by the way, now it's going to be a completely different game you're going to play, you know, okay? So just to say, like, everything is changing at the same time. But basically, we need to understand that the rules of the game are changing right now. And our leaders at the moment, the one I've been discussing with at some occasions, not all of them, but some of them, do not get this.
I mean, I think... One of the things that I'm a bit scared of is that this crisis of imagination that is engendered by the crisis as well, and how difficult it is to kind of imagine a future, whether good or bad, to be honest. Like, it really does feel like the end of history.
That's important to say, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the point I would like to highlight after that.
And so... to me, when I think about like eco-fascism, you know, I think about nations kind of like pulling up the drawbridge, focusing only on their own people, focusing on the resources that are available to them, not collaborating, a much more sort of overtly aggressive world, because we live in a very aggressive and violent world, but like more overtly. And yet, as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that like a difference now compared to any other point in history is how globally networked the ruling classes or the elite is. And so we might not see eco-fascism ever in the way that we used to see fascism, because previously an elite network were also tied to the resources of the geography of the space that they controlled. Whereas now, because the elite are dispersed and are everywhere and kind of are cross international, and they cross borders and their money crosses borders, we might not see this same response. What we might see is more of and I don't like it, I don't like the them and us narrative, but still, we might see more of a them and us narrative where there is this kind of very disconnected, dispersed global response from people who have the opportunity to create their own supplies of energy and create their own goods or take over controls of certain parts of supply chains. And then the rest of the world are just kind of like abandoned.
Yep. But that links with the point I was trying to say earlier on as well, like the fact that we are terrible to we don't know how to share.
hang on. This big, is doing a lot of work there.
Of course.
Humankind does know how to share. We've studied this.
I knew this. I mean, this is what I'm saying. I'm not against the fact that we're sharing all the time. Like, it's not the problem. It's the fact that we got like a part of humanity that just wants to accumulate and just take control of stuff. And it's not from me what I'm going to say. I don't know. So I'm sorry for if someone listened to this and I failed to remember your name. But the thing is, one of the best allegory and metaphor I've read about this was absolutely brilliant. I love this. So I'm going to quote this person I don't remember, but it's actually like, if you and I, we're becoming anthropologists, right? And we're going to somewhere in Africa to study a species of monkeys, okay? So for weeks and months. And then we notice that there is one monkey in a tribe that starts to collect all the bananas, all of them. I don't know, have you heard about this one, this story, before?
I think I know what the monkeys do to this monkey.
Yeah. We'll see. So you tell me. You tell me idea. But just like, it's starting to collect all the bananas and just eating his own portion, right? But like in a herd, putting everything, okay? Basically, there is no more banana left for the other ones, right? And all the bananas are starting to rot somewhere else. but he is satisfied and he has all of them. So basically, at some point, the other monkeys are going to be like, hey, we need to eat as well. You have the bananas. They're still eaten. You took everything. Like, they're going to create this kind of tension and crisis within the group, right? But us, with this kind of eagle-eyed vision from anthropologists, like, we are not concerned by the problem. The first thought we're going to have would be like, this monkey is sick. Mm-hmm. This is sickness. Mm-hmm. Like, it's an absolute sickness. Because actually, like, he's destroying his environment. He cannot eat everything he just accumulated anyway, because they're going to be rotten by the moment, by the time that he wants to eat over the weeks and months. And it's creating social tension with the tribe he's living with. So we're going to discover that this monkey is sick, right? The problem for us now as humans is actually, like, not only we're doing this, but on top of this, with the narrative, we're praising people that do that. And do not realize that it's not being left or right here. It's like, I know some people who say, oh, this is really left, but it's not the point. It's actually like, we're praising this kind of behavior, saying this is what is success, by the way, this is success. But the thing is creating tension with the system. And this is what I'm saying to some of my friends that got a bit of money as well, is I'm saying, like, if you don't pay your taxes and stuff like that, like, I know for you, it's like something you lose, right? Like, it's like a number that is going to be decreased and you need this money also for any kind of project. I'm not judging this. But if more and more people that are wealthy do not pay these taxes, they actually, like, do not understand that ultimately they're destroying the system they're living in as well. So the system, everything they're enjoying, like living in the system, is also disappearing, because progressively actually the level of social tension is increasing, because the fairness and the equality, equitability, maybe I would say, is actually not met. So the system you're living in cannot sustain like this if you're raising the tension within the system as well. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say?
Totally.
So from this perspective, we need to be extremely careful. And again, it's a question of narratives. What do we want? What do we need? What do we want is completely different. Mm-hmm. And actually, we're failing to address this point. So I'm jumping into another book, and again, I forgot the name. Like the issue of competitiveness has been released recently. And this is exactly it. We're pressurizing us all the time. Like, we need to work constantly. I've got students that work sometimes 62 hours, 70 hours per week. And they think this is absolutely no work. Yes.
Extra
work on top of this. Like, thinking this is absolutely normal to do so. And they also, it's also encouraged to wear this as a badge of pride. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. been working that much. Like, when does it stop? Mm-hmm. We're facing, like, we need to understand again, it's a question of limits. Any kind of system, it could be an individual, a family, a city, a region, a country, has limits. And why also I'm still going to answer to your question, why in crisis? Because we do not get, again, this sense of limits. We've been told for narrative for a really long time, there is no limits. You can do whatever you want. Yes, of course, this is good to encourage curiosity, progress, to develop new skills, everything you want. Yes, of course, if you want to investigate something, yes, but there are limits. Your body has limits. Your mental health has limits. Your family has limits. The system has limits. But telling us that you can do whatever you want is absolutely, like, problematic.
Of course.
Because you can't. We're saying, of course.
Yeah, I know.
Honestly, it's not that common.
I know. To be
because
fair,
what I'm saying is that, oh, you're stopping me progress. Well, some people say, oh, you're telling me to stop progressing. I've never said that. Knowing that you have limits is actually knowing the framework you are in it, and then you can expand.
I want to flip this though, right? Because this, to add an extraction lens and an exploitation lens. Because one person is inherently limited, one family is inherently limited, our geography is inherently, like, everything is limited. But if you become the person that finds the lever to extract from other people or extract from the earth without paying an equitable share, then suddenly your access to resources becomes limitless, essentially. Yeah. Because this is the lens that I think we always have to put on it, because I think this is the lens that will unite people around the world. And it really is the global north that is last to wake up to it. And I understand why. But in terms of like the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis and the water crisis and the energy crisis and the economic crisis, like it all being essentially the result of exploitation and extraction and inequity and unfairness. And it's called lots of different things, isn't it? Like, you know, it's called sort of like institutional racism or all kinds of, or like sexism and all these kinds of things, which again are all important. But like, if you just keep bringing it back and back and back and back and back to physics, to the laws of physics and to materiality, I think you start, it starts to reveal the reality of the problem, which is in a limited world, people are doing everything to try and be unlimited. And this goes way back. You know, this goes back into like our mythology around, you know, humanity and afterlife and immortality and gods and all of this kind of stuff. Like, you know, these men throughout the ages that have just been desperate to leave a part of themselves behind in order to live forever. I mean, maybe I went a little bit off script there. But I hope we're all thinking it.
No, because I see your point again. I understand how you're formulating this. And I mean, you and I may be expressing differently, but there is a common ground here.
Sure.
Again, it's a question of narrative. And again, it goes back to the point, like, it's absolutely a psychological transition. Mm-hmm. And just stopping to have this kind of envy, it's greed. Actually, like, of and not learning what is satisfying, and it doesn't mean as well that you're going to have a poor life. It's also really important with the narratives and where we're discussing about distorting the reality and just having one narrative that we need to follow and just not nuancing what could be also possible or degrading. Also, this is really what we're facing as well in our science, and I'm sure you came across this many times when you start to discuss about sobriety instead of energy or efficiency. So now it's efficiency starting to be like a keyword, but sobriety is something we shouldn't talk about. Mm. Like at some point, it's like you facing a lot of people like shields on said, no. So because if we don't do that, and you got all this kind of narrative like, oh, we can't fund retirement pension schemes. We can't do that, which actually like, it's actually like just a decision. It's actually finding alternatives. And actually, like, it's actually, this is why I would like also to encourage to have a positive point of view as well. Not to be like blind and just like filling ourselves with false narrative of, oh, everything will be beautiful, don't worry. It's not this. It's actually like, we can also create alternatives. And this necessitates curiosity, investigation, creation. And actually, it's not like, and I'm seeing this around me right now. I'm seeing a lot of people trying to find alternatives that really works. And could be developed to another scale and actually like can help to tackle the problem in different areas. And just sometimes it's also considered as too hobo, like, so we never work. And actually like not really like nothing serious. It's not considered like it's not something serious and not a key alternative, of course, because you don't encourage this. But I can see changes around me, and I can see also people have been, again, everything is dynamic, especially interpretive speaking. People have been discussing 10 years ago on climate change, on flying, for example, now start to realize this now because they started to be impacted as well. They've been also, it's difficult if it's really abstract and you never experience something like deeply with your own core, you can discuss about this, but some people need to really like see a problem. When I see some people like telling me like the river I used to play when I was a kid actually is like dried up for 2 summers in a row. It never happened before. It strikes you. Mm-hmm. It gets you automatically. And then also it can initiate a behavioral change from this. Mm-hmm. But actions drive beliefs as well. So it's like a question of making these kind of actions progressively. And then you start to believe what you're doing. But we need to do like the first step and then another first step and then another one. And progressively, you transforming yourself.
This is little. I love this. I really didn't think that it was the psychological transition that we were going to talk about, but I do love it. And there's this little.
That could be the title, actually.
Yeah. I think it will be. I think there's this little like phrase that I want to because I think you'll love it. I want to give it to you. I can't remember who said it either. Thank God we're both bad with names. Normally it's just me, and it's we are a. Based kind of on the monkey thing and based on like the creative capacity of most of us and the collaborative capacity and the reason why there should be a lot of hope. For the moment, we are a society of altruists governed by psychopaths. That's the... I know, that's the killer phrase.
Your signature. Yeah.
Which I think is so interesting to think about in terms of complexity as well, because people can only misbehave that badly when they are not being held to account by their community, when they are like essentially using resources to build walls, whether that be like energy walls or resource walls or service walls or whatever, between them and the community that they're impacting. But it all does also mean that if we can just figure out something about what to do about those sick monkeys, we can figure out how to help those sick monkeys. As you say,
exactly.
There's a lot of reason to be.
That's my work, actually.
Yeah.
No. I'm not saying this because they are not sick. I mean, so let's be honest. Like, that was just for the comparison with the monkeys that I was saying. But I'm going also to, I love the fact you took the allegory of walls. So what, because I'm discussing more and more about this. It's not actually like people can have walls with their biases on how they see the world, right? But also we do. And we need to understand that as well. It's the fact that my work is actually to try to find how to make bridges with people that got like another point of view on this. Okay. Like, of course, accumulating a little bit of comfort is absolutely necessary for us. We all have our little for comfort. Myself right now with you, I'm having my laptop. It had a cost as well. Okay. So the point is, what I'm developing more and more is that you like to develop discussions and communication skills on how can I bridge with you? What are your interests? Like, what are your needs? Because if we keep continuing to have this kind of black and white position, we're not going to make changes. And actually, so the idea is actually like, okay, I would like to bridge with you. We have different way to see the world. We're voting differently. Your capital is really important. Okay, fine. Okay. I'm taking you for who you are. But no matter who you are and no matter who I am, actually, we're facing this kind of massive changes, environmentally speaking, energetically speaking, and resource speaking as well. If you do not integrate this, you and I, both of us, are going to be impacted. And if we want to, as you said, like the individual, you mentioned that in a way, I understood that we're like individual are quite weak in some ways. Like us, you and I, like just if I'm myself now, in the middle of the Amazon forest, completely naked with nothing, I'm not going to last more than 24 hours, right?
Yeah.
So the strength of humanity is through the network and the way we're collaborating. And this is the problem also we emphasize, again, like this kind of narrative, like we need to be in competition constantly. And I told you, like with this book, I'm sorry, Bruce, I can't remember your last name, but the issue of competitiveness is there. It's actually like now we need collaboration. So more we're going to create wars between us, like scientists, that people that understand the problem of climate change, this is what I'm saying about us, the problem with energy and resources, and people that do not yet, because they're going to be impacted by it no matter what, maybe less than others, that depends on the capital and supply. If we keep going to just say like, you are the bad people, this is certain that nothing is going to be done. And I know it looks like utopist, but this is what my work is doing. And the team I'm working is doing it. One of the person I wanted you to contact maybe, is actually like, no. We find alternatives. We find stuff. And actually we can see that making a space for communication, making them understanding not with only the physical fact, but understanding what you need and what kind of concrete action we need to implement as well back, actually we're starting to harvest really good fruits at the moment at really high levels of decision makers. So I know it could, for some people, I'm sorry, I'm French, I'm going to do this joke. I know it could sound really cheesy, but don't care, I like this one. No, but the thing is, like, enough with, like, black and white. Because this will not lead to anything. We need, of course, like, this kind of confrontational idea sometimes to initiate a debate. Yes, I'm not saying that this is not, it's not useful. But now, okay, and what next then? Mm-hmm. What are we doing after that? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can we do something like in order to build bridges instead of like, you are bad, I'm good, or you're good, I'm bad, and something like that. Like, but this is the challenge. This is also the challenge as well. Now the challenge is there as well.
Yeah.
Can we re-implement our supply chain anyway? They could go on forever on this.
No, no, no. I get it. I just want to add a layer of complexity to the gray thing. Yes. The banality of evil, right? Like most people are not evil. In fact, people typically not evil, merely perpetuating certain systems, only in their positions because they will behave in a certain way, often don't really know what they're doing, yada, yada, yada. By the same token, there are bad actors. Like we know that there are bad actors in the world who are out to sort of increase their own self-interest. Yeah.
I agree.
And I think what's very important is that I think what we're seeing around the world right now is like the leadership class is sort of made up of a lot of bad actors. In the West in particular right now. It is kind of shocking, but what gives a lot of hope, I think, is that, I mean, I interviewed Sally Gerner years ago. She's an amazing, amazing researcher, and she was looking at revolutions throughout the ages. And she was saying that society changes when the class just below the leaders decide that they've had enough. So essentially, the people who are in the same room as the decision makers, but maybe not making the decisions. And so to access those people, explain, build bridges, really reveal the problem, because there aren't enough bad actors in the world to be filling up every single decision space, every single boardroom around the world, which means that there must be people in those boardrooms that we can access, that we can explain, who will then, you know, do what is necessary to remove those bad actors from their positions of power. It's literally science, she says, journalist.
I didn't say anything. I completely agree with you. And I hope it didn't come across like I was against this. Literally, this is where we're targeting right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is what we're targeting right now.
Yeah.
Because we know that this layer, as you described, actually is the one that the culture change and automatically is going to ostracized. Like if you have like a growing part, a growing body within your system that starts to really get this, the leaders that have been implemented with the old ideas are going to be ostracized. And this is what's happening like dynamically, naturally in our systems.
Yeah.
With the, like, you can see over the last 20 years, like politically speaking, how the landscape politically speaking changed as well. It's because like, not for our ideas, I'm saying, but like for other ideas that starting to come like even more common because they've been taken, but the old leaders are not there anymore.
Exactly.
So this is
push them off a cliff.
Sorry.
What? Sorry.
Yeah. No. I'm sorry. Blind it happens.
Listen, but, your students are probably hanging outside the door, and I still have.
No, I've got 3 minutes left, so that's okay. I took this kind of gap, so we can conclude if you want now. But just we have 3 minutes to conclude. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, listen. My final question for you is: who would you like to platform?
I've got so many, but I don't know names anymore. So. So I would on this kind of behavioral change, and there is Chris DeMayer, which is actually like someone I'm working with. Actually, is working a lot on actions drives beliefs. Actually, so he's like a neuroscientist. So what I'm bringing into the team is more like this kind of physical and social, economical component, and with language psychology, this kind of interdisciplinarity, because we need this. Chris DeMayer, for sure, he has a really good TED talk. Simple that it describes what we're doing. I mean, this is the main one, and I got all the names. I think I can send that to you later, but this for sure, because actually is giving us also another way to look at climate change that we used to look at it. It's not only from the physical side of it, it's also from the psychological side of it. What we can implement and how we can start all of us to implement this kind of little tiny changes that drives our actions, our beliefs, and hopefully for a lot of people, developing this kind of virtuous cycle.
Excellent. Jonathan, that's thank you so much for your time today. This is so much fun.
It was a pleasure. I hope you liked it. I mean, I really appreciate to spend time with you, and see you around with pleasure.
If you want to learn more, I've put links to everything over on planetcritical.com, where you can subscribe to support this podcast and read the weekly newsletter inspired by each interview. If you liked this episode, leave a review and share it far and wide. If you loved it, choose a paid subscription at planetcritical.com to join the community. As always, my deepest thanks to that community. Planet Critical wouldn't exist without your support. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for coming on this journey together.